content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 22nd, 2024 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week is a barroom scene. Dimly lit, it looks like there's been a brawl. Broken tables, pictures on the wall are crooked, broken glasses. At the bar, the Democratic donkey is sitting there nursing a beer. He's got a black eye and a bloody nose. His left arm is in a sling and bandaged up. He's got a Vote Harris Waltz 2024 button and a tear coming out of his left eye. The headline is, After the Beating, Democrats Reckon with a Bruising Defeat and How to Rebuild Their Party. I think we get that in the maybe Controversy of the Week and Talking Points, but we'll start with the first main story. Trump's MAGA administration takes shape. What happened? President-elect Donald Trump began tapping hardliners and loyalists to serve in his administration this week, issuing a flurry of cabinet nominations and announcing that Elon Musk would assume a role helping to dismantle the federal bureaucracy. Trump rattled the Pentagon by naming Fox and Friends co-host Pete Hegseth, a former Army National Guard captain with no executive experience, to be defense secretary. Hegseth is an opponent of diversity and equity initiatives in the military. Trump has promised that under his presidency, the woke stuff will be gone. For attorney general, he nominated Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, a pit bull Trump defender who is under congressional investigation for alleged sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, and misuse of campaign funds. For head of Homeland Security, Trump chose South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, a MAGA favorite who once gifted Trump a 4-foot replica of Mount Rushmore with his own likeness included, and in a recent memoir boasted about shooting dead her misbehaving dog. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, a moderate, was nominated for Secretary of State. Trump named former Democratic Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who has echoed Russian President Vladimir Putin's talking points on Ukraine, as National Intelligence Director. Florida Representative Mike Waltz, a former Green Beret, to be National Security Advisor. New York Representative Elise Stefanik, a staunch defender of Israel, as U.N. Ambassador. And immigration hardliner Tom Homan as his border czar. Trump demanded Senate Republicans embrace recess appointments, which would allow him to install his cabinet picks without Senate confirmation. Senate leaders must agree to such appointments so his selections can be confirmed immediately, he wrote on Truth Social. Trump announced that Musk and former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy will lead a new Department of Government Efficiency. The pair will slash excess regulations, cut wasteful expenditures, and restructure federal agencies, he said. Trump met with President Biden in the White House, where the two had a jovial exchange, and Biden promised a smooth transition. I very much appreciate that, Joe, said Trump, who in 2020 refused to meet with Biden after the Democrat won the presidency. What the editorial said. Trump's demand that the Senate accommodate recess appointments must be soundly rejected, said National Review. The framers allowed for temporary appointments when the Senate was at recess to ensure continuity of government. But to let Trump use that arcane rule to ram through his picks without confirmation would undermine a key check on the president's power. Republicans will have a clear majority of at least 52 seats, said the Washington Post. Trump's strong-arming suggests he wants to elevate appointees whom even some Republicans cannot tolerate. With his appointment of Homan as border czar, Trump is advancing his promise to conduct the largest deportation operation ever in U.S. history, said the Wall Street Journal. How that would unfold depends on just what Trump envisions. In recent interviews, Holman said the priority will be migrants who pose public safety threats and national security threats, and rejected the idea of mass sweeps. That's a positive sign. Trump realizes support will ebb if the public sees crying children and their parents as their parents are deported, or long-settled families torn apart. What the columnist said. Dream on, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. As acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Trump's first term, Holman executed Trump's family separation policy. He's promised a historic deportation operation in which no undocumented immigrant is off the table. Meanwhile, Trump has named as deputy chief of staff the anti-immigrant zealot Stephen Miller, who's worked up plans to have the National Guard round up migrants en masse and warehouse them in military camps. This is what's coming, and no one should be shocked when it happens. Trump's Hegseth pick shocked Washington, said Joe Gould in Politico. Even those braced for surprises were stunned at his nomination of a TV host with no beltway or defense policy experience to lead the world's most powerful military, and a department with a budget of over $800 billion. Who is this effing guy? Said one defense industry lobbyist. His selection drew immediate backlash from veteran groups and amplified fears Trump plans a swift and divisive overhaul at the Pentagon. Hegseth is an unconventional pick, said John Noonan in National Review. But he's got a serious pedigree as an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran and as a graduate of Princeton and Harvard. There's deep rot at the Pentagon, and it needs a jolt to its system that just such an outsider can deliver. I've dealt with Hegseth, and he's a horror show, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. Beyond unqualified, Hegseth is an opportunistic sycophant who'd let Trump run roughshod over the Pentagon. His nomination must be defeated. Trump is fulfilling what he sees as his mandate, said Stephen Collison in CNN.com, building a governing team in his own hardline MAGA image. His picks will send shudders down liberal spines, and that's part of the point. With a common trait of ultra-loyalty to Trump, they're on board with his plan to shred the regulatory state and tell the rest of the world that from now on, it's America first. Whether the Senate will confirm picks such as Gates and Gabbard remains to be seen, but Trump voters who hope for shakeups in Washington are getting what they asked for, and what Harris voters feared. And a shorter second main story. Ukraine readies for drastic change in U.S. alliance. What happened? War-battered Ukraine this week grappled with ramifications of the U.S. election as President-elect Donald Trump reportedly asked Vladimir Putin in a call not to escalate the conflict, even as 50,000 Russian and North Korean troops began their attempt to drive Ukrainians out of the Russia region of Kursk. Kremlin denied a call occurred between Putin and Trump, who has claimed he could bring peace to Ukraine within 24 hours. Russia struck Ukraine with hundreds of drones, bombs, and missiles over the past week, targeting residential neighborhoods in Odessa and using camera-enhanced drones to hunt civilians leaving their homes in Kherson. Ukraine responded with 84 drones launched at Russian territory, including a 34-drone attack on Moscow that shut down airports and injured five. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who praised Trump's peace-through-strength approach, congratulated him in a call that included Elon Musk, who has reportedly been in regular contact with Putin. Still, Donald Trump Jr. taunted Zelensky with an Instagram post that read, "You're 38 days from losing your allowance." The Biden administration vowed to fast-track the remaining $6 billion in congressional-approved aid and let U.S. military contractors enter Ukraine to help maintain military equipment. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told NATO officials that every dollar we have at our disposal will be pushed out the door between now and January 20th to help Ukraine fight or negotiate a peace from a position of strength. What the columnist said. Trump had better realize soon that Putin is not his friend, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. Trump has derided Zelensky as the greatest salesman in history for securing $175 billion in U.S. aid, and the entire MAGA wing of the Republican Party backs Trump's desire for a thaw with Russia. But Putin has made no sign that he plans to grant favors to the leader of a nation he still deems to be Russia's mortal geopolitical enemy. It's Zelensky, actually, who may welcome Trump's victory, said The Economist. With the Biden administration preoccupied with avoiding escalation, Ukrainian leaders increasingly think a wild card president could hardly be worse. Trump wants a peace plan. The question is whether it will be one that forces Ukraine to cede land with no real restraints on Putin, or a deal that trades territory for Western military and financial support, plus possible NATO membership. Security matters more than Ukraine's pre-war borders now, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Trump will look less like a deal-making genius if he chooses a settlement that forces Ukraine to disarm without international security guarantees. That all but invites a repeat invasion, and Russia could then marshal Ukrainian conscripts and vast Ukrainian deposits of natural gas and rare earth minerals. Ukraine could survive without NATO membership, but Ukrainian demilitarization, a central goal for Putin, must not be part of the package. Controversy of the week. Democrats, where does the party go from here? As Democrats sift through the wreckage of their shattered coalition, one question should jump out at them, said Rui Teixeira in the Liberal Patriot. Who is the Democratic Party for exactly? It was no surprise last week that Donald Trump made further inroads with his base of white working class men, but the Republican also improved on his 2020 vote share with Latinos, Asians, urban voters, and young voters. Even women predicted to turn out in droves to protect abortion rights voted for Vice President Kamala Harris by a smaller margin than for Joe Biden in 2020. Most devastating to Democrats' self-image, voters with household incomes below $50,000 and below $100,000 broke Trump's way, making it official that the GOP has become the party of America's working class. Some liberals are already blaming dumb workers for not knowing their own interest, but sneering won't revive the fortunes of a party that desperately needs to rebuild its bond with a common man and woman. There is no quick fix, said Alex Gabriel in The Hill, but the first step, clearly, is to accept that the progressive agenda, while vital in many ways, has become increasingly untethered from the concerns of the average voter. Progressives aren't the problem, said Bob Henley in Salon. On issue after issue, health care, climate, gun control, housing, working-class voters prefer progressive policies to Republican ones. Those millions of votes were there for Harris' taking, until she decided to campaign with former GOP Representative Liz Cheney and run as a Glock-wielding pro-business centrist. The Democrats who won where Harris lost ran to the left on economic issues, said David Lenhart in the New York Times. Candidates like Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez, 36, reelected in Ruby Red Washington State District, and Ruben Gallego, 44, who took an Arizona Senate seat, campaigned as blue-collar populists, ordinary people just as fed up as their neighbors with high prices and corporate greed. In the success of these young pragmatists, Democrats had the beginnings of a new winning formula. Style is everything, said Maureen Dowd, also in the Times. Democrats in the Trump years became the party of condescension and cancellation. As the nation's self-appointed language police, they shamed anyone not fluent in gender-fluid pronouns and faculty lounge terminology like BIPOC and Latinx. They embraced unpopular academic ideas like defunding the police and letting biological males play women's sports. This intellectual and moral preening played well with white affluent college graduates, the only cohort where Democrats made gains last week. But it alienated half the country, or more. This is 2004 all over again, said Nate Silver in his Substack newsletter. John Kerry's defeat that year left Democrats distraught. But in 2008, Barack Obama romped a victory, and it was Republicans wondering if and how they'd ever win again. Given Trump's likely excesses over the next 4 years, that pattern could easily repeat, especially as Trump beat Harris by only 2 percentage points. Democrats have as much to learn from Trump's victory as from their own defeat, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times. Even at 78, Trump's comfort with new forms of media, from AI memes to niche podcasts, contrasted favorably with Harris' cautious traditional campaign of speeches and workshop talking points. Yes, Democrats can draw comfort from previous resurrections in 2008 and 1992, but what comes next needs to be new. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for bunker diplomacy. After the office of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol confirmed to CNN that Yoon is working on his golf game for the first time in 8 years to prepare for the return of Donald Trump to the Oval Office. Yoon's decision to pick up his clubs again was apparently based on the advice of those around him. It was a good week for central planning. After reports that Russia may create a Ministry of Sex to boost the nation's plunging birth rate. One policy under consideration is a suspension of internet access from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. to encourage couples to seek more birth rate raising forms of entertainment. And it was a good week for limitlessness. After Hertz apologized for a clerk who slapped a $10,000 surcharge on a bill of a customer who drove 25,000 miles on a month-long unlimited miles rental deal. We sincerely regret this customer's experience, said Hertz, confirming that unlimited means without limits. But it was a bad week for public safety after Argentina's anti-bureaucracy czar called for the scrapping of a 1974 law that makes the national president the godparent of every family's seventh child to prevent them turning into a werewolf. In an ex post, Federico Sturzenegger said the medieval myth of the Labazon has no place in modern democracy. It was a bad week for tie-ins. After thousands of dolls for the new Wicked movie were pulled from stores because a URL on their packaging directed children to Wicked.com, a porn site. Parents are advised that the misprinted, incorrect website is not appropriate for children, said toy maker Mattel. Finally, it was a bad week for making a mark. After the New Orleans Saints' newly hired interim head coach, Darren Rizzi, confessed to clogging the toilet during his first trip to the head coach's private bathroom. I'm like, okay, this is not really a great start to the day, Rizzi told reporters. Mm-hmm. And time for the briefing. Title this week, The New Threat from North Korea. Kim Jong-un is now directly aiding Russia's war in Ukraine. What does he want in return? How is North Korea helping Russia? The Hermit Kingdom's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, last month deployed 10,000 of his country's most elite troops to Russia's Far East to train in Russian uniforms with Russian weapons alongside Russian soldiers. By last week, some of them were already seeing combat in Kursk, a Russian border region that Ukraine invaded in August in an effort to regain momentum in Europe's biggest conflict since World War II. The manpower assistance is a direct result of the security pact Kim signed with Russian President Vladimir Putin in June, during Putin's first visit to North Korea in 24 years, which provides for mutual defense in the event of an external attack. The North Korean troops will help shore up the Russian military, which has suffered an estimated 650,000 casualties in the 2 years since it invaded Ukraine. It's a huge escalation from Pyongyang's earlier support for Moscow's war effort, which included providing millions of artillery rounds, as well as anti-tank rockets and ballistic missiles. What is North Korea getting out of this? The cash-strapped dictatorship is receiving food and oil from Russia, which helps alleviate its dependence on China, as well as upgrades to its satellite and rocket technology. But that's not all. By deploying to Russia's front line, North Korea's military, which hasn't fought in a large-scale war since it invaded South Korea in 1950, is gaining invaluable battlefield experience. Its soldiers are getting a close look at Western defenses and learning how to use drones and electronic warfare. And now Putin owes Kim. Sending weapons is one thing, but sending your own men is another level, said Rachel Lee, a North Korea expert at the Stimson Center. If things heat up on the Korean Peninsula, Kim has reason to count on Russia. South Korea fears that could mean Russian weapons or even troops being deployed against it in the event of a war. Does Seoul expect open conflict? The signs are worrying. Reversing the long-standing policy of his father and grandfather, who both sought reunification of the two Koreas, Kim Jong-un in January declared the South his principal enemy. This year, he has demolished the reunification monument erected by his father, Kim Jong-il, dismantled reconciliation agencies, and ramped up a Cold War-style psychological campaign, sending thousands of helium balloons across the border to drop bags of trash and propaganda leaflets on the South. In October, North Korea dynamited the unused rail and road links between the two countries that had been built aspirationally some two decades ago. North Korea said it was responding to South Korean provocation, claiming Seoul had flown drones over Pyongyang, but it may have also been trying to get the attention of the U.S. In recent weeks, North Korea has tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile as well as a flurry of short-range missiles. What does Kim want from the U.S.? Possibly economic aid. North Korea is desperately poor, with nearly half of its population malnourished. Successive U.S. administrations tried to keep it from going nuclear by offering aid and sanctions relief, and then, after that failed, tried to persuade it to denuclearize using the same carrots. Each time, North Korea would accept whatever it could get and then renege on its promises. In 2018, it looked as if that cycle might be broken when then-President Donald Trump took the unprecedented step of meeting with Kim and even traveling to the North. But ultimately, nothing came of the brief thaw in relations. The Kim dynasty has always seen the U.S. South Korea's defender as an existential threat, and nuclear weapons as its only protection against a U.S. attempt at a regime change. In the last few years, Kim has expanded his stockpile to some 50 nuclear warheads and enough material to build 40 more, raising concerns in both the U.S. and South Korea. Does the U.S. expect him to attack South Korea? Not immediately. While Kim is certainly laying the groundwork for an invasion, North Korea is not ready to attack, said Andrew Yao of the Brookings Institution. There have been no signs of military preparation, such as troop mobilization, and the regime would hardly send some of its best-trained troops to Russia if it were plotting war at home. Threatening the U.S. and then backing down after getting some economic relief is its modus operandi. Still, with Trump returning to the presidency, Kim's actions are unpredictable. Provocation on the border could tumble the two Koreas into conflict inadvertently, and the U.S. is committed by treaty to South Korea's defense. There are also tempting American targets right in the neighborhood. Camp Humphreys, the Army's largest overseas base with 28,500 troops plus 12,000 contractors and military family members, lies a mere 60 miles from the demilitarized zone. Should the U.S. be worried? Just days before the U.S. election, North Korea successfully launched a test of an intercontinental ballistic missile that flew for 86 minutes, the longest it had yet achieved. That shows the country is closer than ever to a nuclear weapon that can hit the U.S. mainland. I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that the defense of the homeland against nuclear attack should be a primary consideration in the formation of U.S. policy, said Ankit Panda, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We need to be vigilant. Time for a few of the best columns. First one comes from the U.S. The alternate reality of new media. The mainstream media is rapidly losing its influence over American politics, said Amanda Marcotte. That's one of the central lessons of the 2024 election. When given an explicit choice, most Americans actually prefer Democratic policies on health care, abortion, wages, family leave, taxation, and the economy. Polls from earlier this year, in fact, found that people who consume news from journalistic outlets, newspapers, network news programs, and news websites overwhelmingly plan to vote for the Democratic candidate. But roughly half the country now consumes an all-propaganda media diet from Fox News, TikTok, Instagram, X, right-wing podcast, and what their magnified friends and family tell them. These sources immerse their audiences in a separate reality of misinformation, resentment, and conspiracy theories in which vaccines are dangerous, scientists are evil, America is a hellhole overrun by criminals and vicious migrants, Ukraine isn't worth saving, and the economy is in the toilet. Progressives are often accused of looking down on working-class voters, but it's Donald Trump and his allies who see the poorly educated, as Trump calls them, as gullible yahoos who are stupid enough to believe their lies. When voters are bathed in false information, they often make bad choices. This column comes from Ireland. What to do with too much wealth? Ireland has more money than it knows what to do with, said Emma Walsh. While most of Europe is drowning in debt, our government has piled up a $27 billion surplus this year, thanks to all those tech companies we lured with sweetheart tax rates. One chunk of the revenue influx is the $15 billion haul in back taxes from Apple, which, ironically, we fought so hard against receiving out of fear of upsetting our cash cow. But a lot of it is the major boost in income tax from the strong job market, which generated $36 billion this year, with even more on the way in 2025. The problem is our legacy of penny pinching means we cannot spend it. We're not used to being a high-income country. In the 1980s, when unemployment topped 16%, we were spending 15% more than we took in. Things picked up in the mid-90s with the Celtic Tiger era, but the cheap borrowing and the excessive spending led to utter collapse in the 2008 financial crisis. Determined not to let that happen again, we saddled ourselves with strict commitments not to use windfall corporation tax receipts to fund permanent or recurring expenditure. Now our lean years are haunting us because they've left us stuck spending a fraction of what our counterparts across Europe do on housing, healthcare, and roads. While Ireland is a very rich country, it fails to behave like one. This column comes from Canada. Killing our own people on purpose. Canada is hurtling down the slippery slope that opponents of assisted death warned of years ago, said Andrew Phillips. Legalized for the terminally ill in 2016, medical assistance in dying, MAID, expanded in 2021 to those with incurable but non-fatal conditions under a provision called Track 2. A new report by the Ontario Chief Coroner's Office has found that some patients are now being euthanized merely because they suffer from untreated mental illness and addictions. The Track 2 numbers aren't huge. They made up just 2.6% of the province's 4,644 assisted deaths last year, but these also aren't the pain-racked elderly patients we imagine when we think of assisted suicide. They are ordinary people, often the poor, suffering from inadequate housing, a lack of social supports, and simple loneliness. They could live for decades if only they were given something to live for. One man in his 40s who presented with a history of depression and substance abuse, as well as inflammatory bowel disease, wasn't even offered addiction treatment before being approved for suicide. The Right to Die movement was supposed to be about choosing dignity. Yet, what real choice does a person have if they're poor and mentally ill and offered no support? Society has an obligation to help such people live decently, not nudge them toward an early death merely because it's cheaper. Time for the last word, our feature article, The Fast and the Furious. In a Texas classroom, drivers talk about why they got stopped by the cops, said Ruby Kramer in the Washington Post, and try to understand the rolling anger that made them step on the gas. San Antonio. They arrive from the highways of San Antonio, where it is 91 degrees outside, and there is construction on the roads, and cell phones are ringing, talk radio is blaring, people are tailgating. No one will let anyone into their lane. Horns start honking, middle fingers go up, car doors fly open, and another day of road rage is underway in an increasingly angry country. Now, in a small classroom on the edge of the city, Dean DeSoto, 70, looks over a roster for his class on aggressive driving. Good morning, he says, as 19 people walk into the room, looking the way they usually do at the start of class. Tired, annoyed, blank. Most of them don't want to be here, and DeSoto knows this. They are here because they have been ticketed, fined, and sent here by a judge to learn how to manage their anger and anxiety on the road. They take their seats, and he begins to read aloud from a list of their citations, most of which look like speeding violations. 90 and a 65, 94 and a 65, 102 and a 65, 105 and a 65, 112 and a 60. DeSoto, who runs a traffic safety nonprofit that partners with San Antonio's city and county courts, has been teaching his aggressive driving class for 26 years. And in that time, he has come to believe several things. One is that what goes on in the country will play out on its roadways. Another is that anger on the roads is getting worse. Across the country, the number of people injured or killed in road rage incidents involving a gun has doubled since 2018, according to data from the Gun Violence Archive, a nonprofit research group. There is no uniform definition of aggressive driving across law enforcement agencies and no national database to track it. But DeSoto has been keeping his own tally, including cases in Texas involving guns, knives, ice picks, 2x4s, tire tools, PVC pipe, plumbing pipe, bats, hammers, shovels, hatchets, ball bearings, marbles, frozen water bottles, bricks, stones, and, in at least one instance, a spear. On the road, the incidents can begin and end in as little as 30 seconds. But another thing DeSoto has come to believe is that more than just reckless behavior, the cases are a measure of the country's stress, trauma, and polarization. And that made them part of a larger, longer story. So let's start, he says. A young woman goes first. She says she was speeding to pick up a sick aunt. A man next to her says he was speeding to pick up his daughter from school. A man a few seats away goes next. I was coming back from work, he said, and DeSoto, a certified intervention facilitator, gestures for him to keep talking, trying to draw him out. These are not the people with spears, pipes, and knives, but this is a course about the different forms anger can take. You're driving a vehicle that is 3,000 to 7,000 pounds, DeSoto will tell them. You can hurt somebody. Next person, a young woman, speeding because, okay, you're going to hate me, but she begins to say. No, DeSoto says. I'm sorry, but I like to go fast. You go, girl, another man says. Okay, so how fast were you going, DeSoto asks. I was going 103 and a 70. Ooh, one person says, and another starts clapping. In a construction zone, too, she says. A few seats to her right, the next person to speak, a 41-year-old man whose first name is Almir, sits up in his chair and, instead of talking about speeding, says to the rest of the class, people are just overwhelmed. He begins to listen to reasons. Inflation, job insecurity, constant TV, constant news. It's, hey, look at this, look at this, look at this. Should we look at this? Should I look at that? People are just losing it, he says. He had read stories about gunfights between strangers in Texas where, as of 2021, state allows most adults to carry a handgun in public without a permit. He had seen people scream at the nurses and administrators at the hospital where he worked. And it's hot, a girl next to him says. Everything. Humans are just too overwhelmed with just everything, Almir says. And in particular, in my case, I just wanted to avoid the guy. The larger, longer story. If Almir had wanted to explain it fully to the rest of the class, he would have told them that what happened the day he was pulled over wasn't just about an angry and anxious world. It was part of a story that began decades ago when he was growing up in the mid-1990s during the war in Sarajevo. His childhood memories were of grenades, emptied-out buildings, and a neighbor who was abusive, leaving him with trauma he couldn't talk about for years. Then there was bullying at school, skipped classes, and nights he ran away from home, sleeping in abandoned houses. When his family resettled in the United States, he began to see that any situation could provoke him into a reaction. It wasn't until he was in his 30s and met his wife, a licensed professional counselor, that he started to realize why. She encouraged him to see a therapist. In the beginning, he talked until he overwhelmed himself with crying. "If you cry, you cry," his wife told him. "Let it out. It's an emotion." None of which he says in class. What he does say is, "I also got a short fuse." He turns to the girl who likes to drive fast and says, "I understand what she's saying. She's going to slow down as she grows older. When I was younger, you need something. You're understanding this world." After a few days, 10 students return to DeSoto's classroom, here again because a judge considered their citations serious enough for a second, more intensive session of the aggressive driving course. They sit in the circle of chairs, and this time, halfway through the class, a 26-year-old man walks into the room and takes a seat in the corner. "This is Colton Bonk," DeSoto says, and he tells the class Bonk is here to talk about his own life with anger. "Kind of a long story," Bonk says. Bonk was also speeding. In his case, it was through downtown Fredericksburg, Texas. A police officer had pulled him over, but instead of keeping the car in park, he put it in drive and stepped on the gas. He saw the cop car behind him, then more than one cop car. "I've seen the footage. It's not good," he says. He kept driving until he flipped his Dodge Ram 2500, was ejected from the driver's seat, put his face through the windshield, hit his head on the concrete, and broke 23 bones, including his ribs, sternum, and scapula. He was airlifted to a hospital. When he woke up, he didn't know who he was or recognize his parents. What he would eventually remember was how he'd gotten there. He was an alcoholic, and his anger had begun when he was 19 years old and a scholarship student at St. Louis University. One night, a fight with his girlfriend became physical. "I had a couple of black eyes, and I threw her on the ground. It took me years to even talk about that, but that's what I did," he said. The next day, he was arrested by campus police officers, accused of domestic violence, and later charged by the state. "He left Missouri, lost his scholarship, and blamed everyone around me," he says. "The anger progressed and progressed, man. By 22, he got a DWI, went to rehab, got out, moved into a sober living house, relapsed, got a second DWI, moved back into sober living, and then came the night he was stopped in Fredericksburg and decided to take off. The last time I drank when I was in Fredericksburg, I can't tell you exactly what was going through my mind," he said. "The police officer had you," DeSoto says now. "The car was in park. What did he tell you?" "Don't put it in drive." That hair trigger kicked in. "What triggered that?" "I mean, probably a few things," Bonk says. "Fire away." "One was just fear and trauma," he says. "I got to the point where I started being angry even when I wasn't drunk. Somebody would look at me wrong in the room, and I'm like, the effing is this guy's problem, dude." Now Bonk looks out across the classroom. "I mean, we all get angry, right?" he says. "You blame other people, you blame other things, you blame other people on the road for how they're driving or whatever it is, but you play a part in everything, dude. Trust me." "All right," DeSoto says when the class is nearly finished. "What have you picked up? Or did it go in one ear and out the other?" They go around the room as they'd done in the beginning. "I'm just more conscious of my state of mind," a man said. "Maybe I shouldn't be speeding around," another says. "Okay," DeSoto says, turning his attention to the woman who a few minutes before had been telling Bonk how she ended up going 92 miles per hour on the interstate. "Haley?" She was 20 years old. She had been living on her own since she was 18. She explained one day outside of the classroom. She had been working at a restaurant and earned just enough money for rent, groceries, and a white Camry, which she was driving the night she was pulled over with a load of freshly done laundry in the back seat. At the time, she was trying to cut down on marijuana, which she said she'd been using since she was a teenager. And that was part of one more story in this class. From the ages of 5 to 12, she said, she was abused by someone close to her family. And in the years afterward, therapy, mental health hospitalizations, and a disciplinary program in school called in-school suspension, or ISS, where she remembered sitting in a room and writing the same phrase over and over in a workbook. I'm in ISS because, I'm in ISS because. And now this new program with a workbook where she had been doing her best to answer the questions. Why were you speeding? Trying to show off, pass in front of a sports car? What did you say to the police officer? That I saw him and started slowing down. It was a long day and I just wanted to get home after doing laundry. That I'm broke and didn't have money for the tow car insurance. What did the police officer say to you? That I was going way too fast in a 65 and that it was reckless driving and that they would have to tow my car because I didn't have insurance. In her apartment in the weeks leading up to her citation, she found herself on social media more and more. One night it was scrolling past images of war in Gaza, feeling a dark hole of hopelessness at what she saw. Another night it was videos of influencers sitting on the beach, traveling to places she had never been, in a competition of who's doing better, who has this, who has that, who's making money, who's right, who's wrong, until the night her life had brought her to DeSoto's class, where he is now saying her name. Sorry, she says to him, looking up. What was the question? What have you processed? She says to DeSoto. She talks about watching her speed and keeping distance from other drivers. Just overall trying to be more responsible, she says. Very good, DeSoto says, and Haley returns to the workbook. How do you define anger? Anger is a cover emotion. What emotions trigger anger? Fear, sadness, emptiness. After a few minutes, people begin to pack up their things. DeSoto wishes them luck and hands them each a certificate that will allow them to expunge the citations from their records. They take out their car keys and their phones, and one by one, they begin to leave the classroom, headed back to a highway full of anger and anxiety, until only one person is left seated. Haley, still writing. This story was first published in the Washington Post. And one more election analysis article on the Talking Points page. Election 2024, how Trump won. In its nearly 250-year history, America has never before chosen a president with so many black marks against his name, said James Rainey and Noah Bierman in the Los Angeles Times. Donald Trump is a convicted felon who was judged liable for sexual abuse. He incited a violent uprising in an attempt to overthrow his 2020 election loss. On the campaign trail, he echoed Hitler with his exhortations that immigrants are poisoning the blood of America and calls for retribution against the enemy within. Yet Trump achieved a stunning victory over Vice President Kamala Harris last week, becoming the first Republican to win the popular vote, 50% to 48%, in two decades, and expanding his 2020 numbers in nearly every demographic. Hispanics, young voters, both urban and rural voters, and both men and women. He did it by delivering a populist message with uncompromising ferocity and by harnessing the anger of Americans uneasy about the high cost of living, unsettled about a southern border they view as insecure, and disturbed over an evolving culture they feel has strayed too far from traditional values. Above all, his win came down to voters' economic outlook, said Noah Rothman in National Review. While Democrats insisted all was rosy and that inflation had been tamed, ordinary Americans spoke of wrestling with the surging cost of housing. Rents are up 20% since 2020, groceries up to 40% higher, and borrowing, credit card interest rates are at record highs. In 2020, Biden won voters with a sour economic view by 63 points. Harris lost them by 40. This was a howl of rage against elites, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Over the past four decades, those of us in the educated class have built a post-industrial economy that elevated college-educated knowledge workers and rendered everyone else invisible. As vocational training withered and free trade policy sent industrial jobs overseas, working-class voters, especially men, felt angry and betrayed. Democrats fancy themselves warriors against inequality, but they have become so focused on racial inequality, gender inequality, and LGBTQ inequality that they couldn't see the great chasm of economic inequality staring them in the face. I guess it's hard to focus on class inequality when you went to a college with a multi-billion dollar endowment. Trump spoke to the nation's raging class animosity. 56% of voters without degrees picked him, up 6 percentage points from 2020, and made marginalized Americans feel seen and understood. Trump also scored by leveraging one of the hot-button cultural issues of our time, said Rachel Bachman in the Wall Street Journal, transgender rights. He and his backers spent at least $123 million on TV ads targeting Harris and Democrat support for letting transgender women compete in women's sports. The ads, with the tagline, "Kamala's for they, them, President Trump is for you," not only resonated with blue-collar laborers, but also with high-income parents worried about their daughters playing against transgender girls in school and college sports. Yet, Harris ignored the issue, even as some worried Democrats urged a response. This is all Biden's fault, said Josh Barrow in the New York Times. While warning that democracy was on the ballot, the president prioritized his own ego and profile when he insisted on running again, despite dismal approval numbers. Biden, 81, persisted even as he and aides worked to hide his growing cognitive decline. Following his meltdown in the June presidential debate, he spent weeks contending all was fine, and by the time he finally stepped aside in July, it was too late for anyone other than the uninspiring Harris to take his place. An earlier exit might have produced a primary that could have yielded a stronger nominee, like Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro or Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. A lack of enthusiasm for Harris was apparent on Election Day, said John West and Kara DePina in the Wall Street Journal. Across every core Democratic bloc, black voters, college graduates, union members, and in every liberal stronghold, Democrats failed to show up for Harris in the numbers they did for Biden in 2020. Democrats sat out the election, said Monmouth University pollster Patrick Murray. All these things contributed to Trump's win, but one factor trumped all, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the most badly informed electorate in modern American history. A May survey found Biden leading overwhelmingly among the shrinking number of Americans who still read a newspaper, while Trump held his biggest margins among those who follow no news at all, many of whom bathe in the toxic stew of misinformation that circulates on social media. Having ridden into office on angry voters' grievances, Trump now faces a new challenge, said John F. Harris in Politico. Much of his political mojo is derived from victimhood and the perception that he is valiantly fighting back against entrenched forces. Now he has unambiguously bested those forces. How will he deliver for the broad coalition of voters who've brought his promises of change, who bought his promises of change? We are in for a new chapter of Trump's career and a new chapter in the American presidency. And we've time for one of the short notes. Women are stockpiling abortion drugs out of fear that access to reproductive care could be restricted under a Donald Trump presidency. Aid Access, a major supplier of abortion pills, received 10,000 requests for medication in the 24 hours after the election was called for Trump, 17 times more than a typical day. Just the Pill and Abortion Drug Nonprofit said nearly 20% of the orders it received in the 3 days after the election were from women who are not pregnant. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said, "Never underestimate a man who overestimates himself." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.